Knives Up, Knives Down. Get ready for a plate full of shelf-stable RTEs and hunker down as we take a bite out of the Little Apple. I am your host, Katie Weavey.
And I am Becky Goff, and this is the Little Apple Bites podcast. Today we have Russell Stuckey and Vivian Leva visiting with us for our podcast.
Welcome, guys.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Yeah. Yep. I'm glad you have us.
Absolutely. And then we're going to start the podcast off with, what makes the Little Apple special to you?
And yes, you both get to answer it.
Well, I'm a transplant. I didn't grow up here, so it's a unique area where you have a nice-sized city, but the rural aspect just not very far away, and a nice mix of rural and urban and different activities to do and all just different kinds of people.
Okay.
And I am also a transplant from a little bit farther away. I started off in the West Coast, and I, quite frankly, did not expect to like Kansas as much as I do. And I think my favorite thing is that it's so safe here. That I used to live even close to Aggieville, and I could walk my dog out like late at night, and I felt safe. You have to be aware of your surroundings, certainly. Right. But I mean, I've lived in South Central Los Angeles, where it was not safe at night to be out walking. And now that's something I try to never take for granted, because it really is comforting to me. And that, you know, I can go to the grocery store and I am probably going to run into somebody that I know. I've been here for a decade now. Mm-hmm. But that is just the coolest thing to me. So I love it.
Yes, that's definitely awesome. A like small town, small world feel here.
Yeah, but not so small that everybody knows all your business.
Yes. Yeah.
Definitely. So, Russell, you are the first one that's going to get put in the spotlight here. Can you give us a brief overview of what emergency management does for our community?
So emergency management prepares for disasters and emergencies, tries to educate the public on how to prepare for those disasters and emergencies on a personal basis and a workplace basis. And then during times of disaster, we coordinate different emergency agencies and volunteer agencies that help during disasters. And then after the disaster's over, we also help coordinate the recovery from those disasters. And so whether that's before the disaster, encouraging individuals, businesses, government organizations to do their planning for whether it's a tornado, taking shelter during a tornado or severe weather, or instance of active violence, or whether it's writing out your continuity of operations plan or your COOP plan to how to continue your business or government operation after a disaster happens and you can no longer use your facilities like you normally would under normal circumstances.
Sorry. That's funny. I'm the one who gets to edit this, so it's okay. I'm the one that gets to take out the dead air, and when I'll be the cause of it later. So you said for individuals and businesses, you know, I always think about, like, emergency management's always giving, like, that informational for, like, residents, like, as a, you know, someone who lives here. I didn't actually think about the fact that, you know, you would be working also with, like, businesses in our area to make sure that they know and are prepared for that potential of having a hazard or what have you, or a natural disaster.
Right. And so, you know, our information we try to put out is both a combination of, like I said, individual stuff for schools, stuff for businesses, government offices, being aware to, you know, prepare for those type of weather events or man-made events.
And I've noticed one thing that people don't necessarily know is that emergency management will come and talk to your people about emergency plans or evacuation plans, or if you've got an organization that has a lot of employees and you want to know, okay, how do we do a tornado drill? What's an effective way to make a plan for the most common emergencies in our area? What do we need to do? They'll come talk to you.
And if there is a business that is wanting more information, that's something they can just reach out to your office to get that, to be able to reach you and be able to schedule something like that?
Correct. They just need to call 785 537-6333 and ask for Lori Harrison, and she'd be glad to set up a talk, whether that's to a community group such as, you know, Kiwanis Rotary, or come talk to your business or church or other community organization.
That's awesome. I had no idea that was an option available.
Yeah, it's very cool. And I think it's really, obviously everyone knows it's important to be prepared, and it's important to know what happens in case of an emergency. Why would you say it is most important to be prepared for natural disaster or emergency in this community?
The most important would be just for your family and or business's sanity, your family's sanity and your business's ability to continue on after. Mm-hmm. You know, I think there's been a lot of studies done that show that businesses that are prepared have a much higher percentage of continuing on after a disaster versus those that weren't prepared, and they just end up having to shut their doors because they can't figure out how to get back on track and get the revenue streams back going, and before you know it, they just have to shut their doors because they weren't prepared.
Mm. Yeah.
So there's that old saying, the an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. And I don't know if any of you have ever been through a disaster or an emergency, but you're not doing a lot of rational thinking during the crisis. So if you haven't kind of, I want to say, created those neural pathways, created those patterns, talk to your kids about, okay, if the sirens go off, here's what we're going to do, and you practice it during times of calm, you communicate it, you have a plan, then you can default back to that plan during the crisis when you're not necessarily thinking clearly, and make sure you and your family and your pets are safe. Mm-hmm. We don't necessarily do tornado drills with the dogs, but we've talked about, okay, well, how do we round them up? You know, the sirens freak them out.
Yeah.
Let's make sure, let's go to the basement, have all the things we would need if the worst happens, and some of the stuff that you don't think of necessarily. And this might be TMI, but, you know, you're supposed to plan for about 3 days, 72 hours. What are you going to need for your family, whether it's pet food, your medications, a flashlight, a blanket, all the stuff to stay as comfortable as possible, some games for the kids, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
A bucket and some plastic bags and some zip ties for bathroom needs. If you're stuck in a space that doesn't have a bathroom,
that's a good idea.
Experience will be a lot less miserable if you've got a bucket and some plastic bags and zip ties, so you don't have to smell what's in the bags. And the more I kind of go over plans and spend time with Russell and Lori and emergency management staff, and think, oh, yeah, of course, they don't show that part in the movies.
No.
So I didn't necessarily think about that, but that will make a huge difference, that little bit of planning ahead of time. For your comfort, your safety, of course, most importantly, your safety, your recovery, all of those things, but then your comfort as well. There are lots of things to think of and go through, and we're all busy. You know, we barely have time to go pick up the groceries sometimes, but this is worth investing some time and mental energy in to prepare for and have your kits ready, have your supplies.
And like Vivian said, to use a sports analogy, you know, you play like you practice. And so if you practice having your emergency drills, that's how you're more likely to do it that way during an emergency, like Vivian said, when you're not thinking necessarily rationally. And then another prime example of how there's proof that works is, you know, I don't remember the years now, but 50, 60, 70 years ago, there were a lot of deaths due to fire. And now schools do fire drills, and there hasn't been, for example, there hasn't been hardly any deaths in a school for, I think it's 40 or 50 years now, because if you remember going to school, you always did fire drills. Everybody knows what to do, so hardly anybody has died in recent history due to a fire in a school, because they practice and they practice and they know how to get out.
Very cool. It does take you back to high school and stuff and having to go through, you know, those boring fire drills and everything else, but it is important. And, you know, had I had to do a tornado or something, it's like, yeah, I guess I would have known what to do. And now I probably wouldn't because I don't think about it. But
yeah, you guys got me thinking, I don't actually know what the plan is if we're here when the tornado hits. So I'm sure someone does, but that's definitely not me. So that's a note that I have written down to ask at a later time to be like, hey, so what exactly is our plan here? Because
and especially with like spring coming into full effect very soon, comes storm season, and you know, there's all kinds of things that could happen, but spring especially has like a higher chance of tornadoes and all of those kind of disaster storms that you don't want to think about. But how would you say community members should best prepare at home?
Like Vivian said, have 72 hours of supplies, whether that's medication, toiletries, food, water, readily available to you. You also want your important papers. You want some cash because, you know, if electricity's down, card machines aren't going to work. If you need to go buy something, you need to have that stash of cash, whatever you think it might take you to last, you know, non-perishable food items because the refrigerator may not work after. The stuff in the fridge may not be cold after a day or so. So those are, and then figure out in your home, like Becky was saying here at the studio, if there's not a basement, you need to find the most interior, sturdiest room in, and then that's where your shelter needs to be. If you're in a mobile home or a building that you just don't think is very stable or very well built, then that's when you need to make plans with know your neighbors and figure out who has a basement in the neighborhood and figure out if it's okay if you come knocking on their door during the storm and to help go take shelter with them. Then same way for your workplace and know that your kid's school, especially if it's maybe a private school that isn't as regulated as much as the public schools, you know, check into those type of things.
So I know that there are some communities that have like a community shelter. Is that something that we currently have available in Raleigh County?
No, we don't have any community storm shelters. The different trailer courts, you know, you'll typically find some sort of storm shelter on them, those, but a lot of times you'll find that they may or may not be maintained very well.
Okay.
You know, I've heard stories of, yeah, we went to the shelter, but it was full of leaves and spider webs, and we didn't know what was hiding in those leaves, and so we didn't feel very safe going in there. So,
yeah.
You know, if you're living in a trailer park, then you might want to go inspect that storm shelter now before the storm happens in a week or two or three. And if it's not being maintained properly, then I would talk to management and say, hey, that storm shelter is not up to par.
Right.
There needs to be some work done there so that when the storm's rolling in, you're not figuring that out at that time.
Yeah, I would have to agree with them. If there was a bunch of leaves, I don't know that I would want to find out how many spiders or other creepy crawly things might be in there. So
correct.
Yeah. And then, just lost it. There we go. I'm the one who has to edit. It's fine. We did that.
Then the other thing during severe weather is know how you're going to get notified. You know, it used to be when most of us were growing up, you watched 13 or 27 or 49, and they would come across the screen with weather alerts. But now in the days of streaming services, you know, you don't have that opportunity. And so if you don't have the local radio on or local TV on, it's even more important now to have, whether that's a NOAA weather radio, whether that's at least one, if not two or three apps on your phone that will notify you of severe weather. You can sign up for the county's notification system then and pick which weather events you want to be alerted for and which ones you don't. And then the county system is, in my opinion, probably one of the best, because not only would it alert you to storms, if there's something else going on in the community, such as one thing that's routine is car wrecks and the roads blocked, typically dispatch will put out a message and you'll know, oh, I better hadn't drive down Kimball for the next hour or two, or on TCB or wherever the wreck might be. There's those type of notifications. Other notifications that, knock on wood, since I've been here, we haven't had to do one of these, but if there was an escaped convict or a dangerous person in a neighborhood that the police were chasing, we could put out a message in a certain neighborhood or a certain geographic area. Hey, lock your doors, lock your windows, make sure your keys aren't in your car. There's a dangerous person. you know, being pursued by the police. If there was a large hazardous material spill or some other man-made event that you should avoid an area or take cover, that is the primary way that we're going to be able to notify the public about that.
And I was not in Scouts, but advice that I've received from people who were, they talk about, you know, two is one and one is none, that you always have to have a backup when you're thinking about severe weather in particular and say, well, I've got this app on my phone and it's great. It tells me everything I need to know. In extreme situations, cell phone tower get knocked down. Have that weather radio, have a traditional radio so you get up to the minute broadcasts. You need several ways to be notified. You've always got to have a backup.
Yeah, I was going to say one of my notes on here was about the recent issues that we did have with the notification system, and was going to ask the importance of having more than one option to listen to or be able to be notified about those.
Right. Our local system was actually working properly. It was actually the National Weather Service's RSS feeds is what it's called. I don't remember what that stands for, but they weren't transmitting them properly. And so our system was fine, but it wasn't getting its information from its source properly.
Gotcha.
And so that's why during the last storm, our local Northeast Kansas emergency notification system wasn't working properly.
Gotcha.
But we were still able to send message locally, so we got the messages from a different route, and we were actually able to forward some of those manually.
Yeah.
They just weren't automatic.
Gotcha, yes.
And that's...
I didn't really know, to be honest, I've got multiple multiple apps that tell me what's going on with the weather, so I didn't notice until Vivian had posted about, hey, this Everbridge system is having some issues, and then I was like, oh, I haven't been getting those notifications that I normally also get during that severe weather event. So,
right. But good for you for having backups. That's exactly, like, don't put all your eggs in one basket. This is something that's, you know, potentially life-threatening, involves your safety.
Yeah.
Make sure you have more than one way to get notified.
Yeah, definitely.
Another nice feature about the local system is not only can you put in your home address, you can put in your work address, you could put in an address of your children's school or your elderly parent. And know not only is a tornado warning hitting your area, it, like if your elderly parents across town or across the county or in another county, you can put their address in as an alternate location and know if they're getting severe weather too. And that's an advantage you have with the county's notification system.
Okay. And then I want to go back a little bit and talk about your specific role in emergency management, because I think that that's important too to highlight. There is a lot of moving parts and a lot of different things that go into emergency management. And so can you talk a little bit about like your specific roles and just a brief overview of like what goes into emergency? I know we talked about what emergency management is, but like your specific role.
So my specific role is I'm the director of emergency management. And then so that's 50%, well, a little bit less than 50% of my job. And my other job is being the county fire chief. And so that's just a little bit less than 50%. And then my third hat is the 911 fund administrator. And so that's probably 10% of my job. But as the emergency management director, I oversee the emergency management department, which we have two, other than me, we have two full-time employees for. Lori Harrison is the assistant director. And then Baldwin Fisher is our planner. And so... I oversee those operations in the event that we have to activate the Emergency Operations Center. Either I or Lori would oversee that and be the EOC manager and help coordinate activities throughout the county. Again, like we talked before, we do the several different plans that we maintain for the county, whether that's the Hazard Mitigation Plan or the Emergency Operations Plan or the Active Violence Plan or there's another one that I'm forgetting, but that is overseeing those things and coordinating those different activities like we talked about earlier.
Okay.
And then the other big thing that we do is pre, but especially post-disaster, is working and coordinating with those outside agencies, whether that's other county agencies, state agencies, and or federal agencies, and coordinating a response to a disaster. And so one way some emergency managers put it, when the police and the fire department and the ambulance run out of resources, then they turn to emergency management to find help for them.
Okay. And then you're the PIO, standing for Public Information Officer. Tell us about how that plays a role in emergency management as well.
Can I go back and talk about Russell a
little bit? You can. You absolutely can.
I knew he was going to be a little bit modest. The way that I think of your role and emergency management's role is kind of as the hub of things. When something big happens, when there's a disaster, crisis, emergency, and it takes police and fire and EMS, Russell's going to be in the middle of all that. So this agency is talking to this other agency. If heaven forbid, and lots of knocking on wood here today, but you have to do that.
Well, yeah.
Heaven forbid we have to call in the National Guard for something. But if we have to call in the National Guard, Russell calls them. So he has relationships with all of the other first responders in the area, and then with the other emergency management directors across the state, other departments across the state, and then connections that goes up to the national level as well. So he's the person who declares a disaster locally,
no,
gets it signed.
I recommend to the chair of the commission.
To declare
a disaster, and then the chair decides to actually do it and signs, but yes.
Okay, thank you. Yes. The chair of the Board of Riley County Commissioners mm-hmm. makes the declaration, and then that goes up to the state level, that kind of thing. So I think of you as kind of the hub. He was there during flood times, during COVID, during major disasters. He's the guy who can get the resources. And Lori Harrison, too, and Baldwin Fisher, they make the plans, they do the coordinating, they're kind of in the middle of things if the community is facing a crisis. I just heard on the radio the other day, they're coordinating evacuation for American citizens who are in Haiti right now. Mm-hmm. And it was the emergency manager who got on the interview and was talking about, okay, we got the helicopters here. They're responsible kind of for the logistics of the response, and it's a huge role, mm-hmm. and it takes somebody who's very, very calm, and I very much appreciate that about you. So,
And an example of that's happened in recent, not this year, knock on wood again, is in the past couple years. You know, when we have a big grass fire that's giving us difficulty controlling, and it's in either rough terrain and or homes are getting threatened, and we want to call in aviation resources from the state, where I wear both hats, obviously I can just do that, but the proper procedure is for the fire department to call the emergency manager, the county emergency manager, and then the county emergency manager calls the state to request those aviation resources from the Kansas Forest Service to come help fight a wildfire. And so that's a pretty recognizable example of what Vivian was just describing.
Absolutely. And I am so glad that you stopped me and wanted to talk more, because I agree. Like, there is so many moving parts and so many people that go into this. It's not just one guy calling a couple people to come out and help. Like, it takes a whole village to speak. And so I'm really glad that you wanted to touch on that and highlight some other people that are in your department, because it is really important to have all of those things and those people in place.
Absolutely. I'm grateful they're willing to do this work.
Yeah.
Yeah. But now, Vivian, we are going
to
make you talk about yourself.
Now you have to brag on yourself, too.
So, Vivian, you've been the public information officer for Riley County for a couple of years now. And before that, you did work for the city of Manhattan in a similar role. So tell us now what your role as public information officer has to do with when it comes to the emergency management side of things.
So as public information officer, it's really in the title. I get the information from the responders, from the situation, to the public that they need to know for safety first and foremost, and then to connect them to resources. So if they, I want to think back to 2018, the Wildcat Creek flooded. There were, I want to say, about 300 people who were temporarily displaced.
Mm-hmm.
So it's my job to get the information about where they need to shelter, what happens to them, from emergency management to the people, to the public, also coordinating with the media, because you do the best job of carrying that message to the public. I don't have a radio station at my disposal, but I can get you the information that you need. So you don't have to think, well, who do I need to contact about that? What are all the questions? I am trying to be proactive in getting the information to you so that you can help carry that to the public. Is that,
yeah,
sum it up? Okay.
Yeah.
It's a fun job. I love it.
And we're real fortunate that, you know, Riley County is a big enough county to justify having a full-time PIO. Well, a lot of counties don't have that. A lot of counties, it's another duty as assigned to a county employee, whether that's a clerk, somebody from the clerk's office or health department, or who knows where, you know, a smaller county's PIO is located. And we're real lucky to have Vivian, and she'll, you know, draft press releases or website posts and send them to us. Hey, does this look right? And most of the time they're just perfect and I don't have to make any changes at all. Every once in a while I'll suggest a little change here or there, but she, by us having her do that, that lets us really focus on the other things that we need to focus on and not sit there and have to write press releases and take time away from actually managing the incident.
And we talk about this in other circles, too, just about how complex it is now to communicate to folks, that everybody has their own channel that they or their own method for receiving information. It's not one nightly news broadcast that everybody's sitting in front of their TV and watching that, oh, this person might get their news on a website someplace. This other person might hopefully listen to the radio. Thank you. Glad you tuned in. Or some people get podcasts. Some people have this app on their phone or a different app or read a magazine. You know, that I'm searching for examples, but there are just a myriad of places to get your information.
Right.
So we have to have somebody that is pushing information to all of these places or we're going to miss people. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, the town, I'm just the modern version of the town crier.
And I think, like we mentioned before, but to stress, is when all you do is streaming services, if, you know, if all you do is watch Netflix or watch Amazon Prime or watch, you know, YouTube TV, you're zoned out of the local stuff. And so you need to have that method to make sure you're getting local information in a timely manner.
Absolutely. And then tell us a little bit about what the best part of your job is?
Just the ability to help people. Obviously it's with the fire chief hat, you know, my two deputy chiefs do it mostly, but every once in a while I actually get to turn on the lights and sirens and go to a fire. So, you know, you can't beat that. And every once in a great while, I actually still get to grab a hose and squirt water on the fire. That doesn't happen very often anymore, but, knowing that you're helping people, and whether it's on the emergency management side, knowing that you've at least given people the opportunity to get prepared. Obviously, it's you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink. But just knowing that you've helped people is the best aspect of my job.
He drove the ambulance the other day.
What?
Wow. Yep.
There was a cardiac arrest out on I-70, and we didn't have any volunteers available from those closest fire stations, and I went out there and got there, and the EMS crew said, hey, can you drive us to the ambulance? I was like, it's been a few years since I drove an ambulance, but yeah, we'll get it done. And I got it done and didn't take any wrong turns. So
you got to drive the ambulance while both of the EMS personnel were in the back.
Correct.
Helping the patient.
Correct.
That's awesome.
So, yep.
Just another hat to add on the set.
Just add that to the list of things.
Other duties as assigned.
No, other duties as assigned. Yes, exactly. Ambulance driver. So we've talked a little bit about spring and it being the time when you sometimes encounter fires. But prescribed burning and controlled burns are something that happens a lot in our area. And what is something, like, what does someone need to do if they are maybe a new landowner, or maybe they've had land for forever, but they're new to the idea of a prescribed burn or controlled burn, but need to make that happen this year? What do they need to do to be able to do that?
So a couple of things they need to do first. One, they need to have a county burn permit and read all the instructions and follow the rules and regulations of that permit. And then simultaneously, they need to get on K-State Extension website and or the Kansas Forest Service website and research and learn on how to properly do a prescribed burn. We did host a prescribed burning class 3 weeks ago now, I think 3 weeks ago, and we're really pleased with the turnout. We were hoping for 30 or 40 people, and I counted over 180 people.
Oh, wow.
Out at Potter Hall, and so we were just had to keep getting chairs out, which was great. And so we had a great turnout for that. So learn the research and learn the safety practices. If you've never done it before, I highly recommend you find a neighbor or a friend that has done it before, some other ag producer in your neighborhood. And if you can't find one, you know, you could call our office and maybe we could get you in touch with your local, the station firefighters that serve your area, and maybe they could point out somebody to you that would be a good mentor and somebody to show you how to do it. This is the busy time of the year for, like you mentioned, for control burns, prescribed burns, and so our call volume will more than likely ramp up here over the next several weeks. And again, the big thing is follow the burn resolution. We, as part of the county notification system, that's another thing we use it for, is to alert burn permit holders what days burning is allowed and what days are not. We make that decision by looking at the weather, not only for today, but for the next 2 or 3 days. You know, it may be a good day today to burn, but if it's going to be really low humidity and high winds tomorrow, that's going to influence our decision on how much, if any, burning we allow today. And so keeping pace with that, and if you get your burn permit, then we're going to put you on that notification system so you'll get those text messages and or phone calls to let you know when burning is appropriate and when it's not.
And I know that there's lots of things that you need to do to be prepared for, you know, doing that prescribed burn. What is like the minimum you should have of like safety equipment if you're a landowner wanting to get this started, like things that they should maybe think about purchasing or having available?
So at a minimum, you need it. There isn't one set list because it depends on if you're burning a half an acre or 300 acres.
Right.
So the burn resolution talks about appropriate manpower and equipment. And so that could be everything from, you know, if you're just burning this little quarter acre piece of your backyard and it's surrounded by tilled farm ground that the fire can't escape to, you know, you may be all right with the garden hose from the house that reaches out there and or a couple hand sprayers clear up to, you know, an old military truck and a 1,000-gallon tank and pump to go burn 1,000 acres. And so
Right. It
varies greatly, but typically what we see most people have is, whether it's a four-wheeler or a side-by-side with a water tank and electric pump in it, like Vivian kind of mentioned on notifications earlier, you know, two's better than one. So if you just have one out there and it breaks down, then you can get in trouble fast.
Right.
So, you know, having some sort of backup, you know, maybe it's not two utility vehicles, but maybe it's one utility vehicle and some hand sprayers, gunny sacks and a bucket of water or whatever that might be. And the biggest thing is just don't bite off more than you can chew. You know, don't light more fire than what you can control. And so then the other thing is make sure you have good communications. You know, don't go out and burn somewhere that you know doesn't have good cell phone coverage without having some way to make sure you can notify us, whether that's, you know, a person that's free that can drive to the top of the hill real quickly so that they can get out and make that 911 phone call.
Right.
Having that communication is almost as important as having the equipment to put the fire out. And then, like we kind of mentioned before, having that experience on scene. You know, if you're not a seasoned prescribed burn control burn person, having that knowledge and experience, and maybe that's somebody that isn't physically able to do it anymore, but they've done it for the past 50 years, just out there riding around in the co-pilot seat or giving you advice. So I wouldn't light it down that way. I'd go this way. And having that knowledge is important as anything.
Gotcha. That makes sense. I know that my family's helped a lot of neighbors with burning and stuff. So that makes sense to have like safety in numbers, I guess, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing, and I'm learning this as I spend more time with Russell and the volunteer fire department, you've got to keep track of the weather throughout the day. Checking it once in the morning is not going to be good enough because Kansas weather changes on a dime. The winds can shift, and that will completely change the behavior of your fire. So you've got to get really familiar with the weather, familiar with the terrain, and have an experienced person with you.
And the other piece of that weather is the wind's obviously a big thing, but the humidity levels. You know, if you watch and you get on the Weather Service site or another site, and one thing the Kansas Forest Service talks about a lot is recovery at night. So when the humidity levels come back up at night and you have good recovery, then that doesn't promote fire spread. Whereas when you have those nights that the humidity level doesn't recover, that's when fires smolder all night long, and then as soon as the wind picks up the next day and the humidity goes down even more, that's when the rekindles happen. When you have really good humidity recovery at night, then you don't see nearly as many of the rekindles. But like Vivian said, it's not just that day. You need to go back and check your fire the next day and the day after. And there are occasions where when you burn like brush piles or you get into a bunch of pack rat nests or something, or manure-type piles, those things have been known to smolder for weeks. And we could have, say, a south wind for 2 weeks, and then you could have a fire and be done with it, and 2 weeks later the wind switches, and it's been smoldering out there in this whatever it is, old brush pile or whatever, and then the fire can take off the other way. And it was 2 weeks ago when you had that fire. So
yeah,
you've got to respect it. And as you guys are talking, I'm thinking, you know, the best way to start if you're new and a new landowner, offer to help your neighbor with their burn first. It's different than you imagine it's going to be, and whatever experience you can get, help your neighbors out.
Yeah, that makes sense. I know that there have been some times when I've chased your firefighters around because of out of control burns. And yeah, that there are times when, yeah, you guys on scene trying to put the fire out, the wind will change on you guys and it changes how you have to attack to get it put out yourselves, not just to make sure that it doesn't burn the wrong way. So.
Right. And to go back to add a little more to your original question of what to do is, you know, having the right equipment, having the right manpower on scene, paying attention to the weather, but also paying attention to what exposures you have, or meaning what's on the other side of the fence. Is it a bunch of 6 foot tall grass, or is it a plowed farm field or something in between? You know, knowing your terrain and your access to those. And so if a fire does get across the fence, you know, do you have do you know where the gate is to get over there and try and get it put out before it gets completely out of control? Knowing where your not only your gates but your neighbors' gates are, and notifying your neighbors, you know, that's one complaint we get fairly regular is my neighbor burned and I had my windows open and they didn't let me know they were going to burn and so they smoked us out of our house. So you know, notifying your neighbors you're going to burn is a common courtesy, because what if it's a nice spring day and they're sitting there with their windows open, and then you send a big old cloud of smoke across their place? They're not going to be very happy with you.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Not to mention if it's the weekend and they were having the kid's birthday party in the backyard and then all of a sudden you smoke them out, probably not going to be real popular.
Yeah, not the most neighborly thing to do there. Yeah.
Yep.
That makes sense. Well, Katie?
Yeah, I think that's all looking. The questions that we had. But is there any like key takeaways or anything that we didn't cover that you think would be important to know?
So on the fire side, on the fire district side, you know, and outside of the city of Manhattan, of course, the city of Manhattan has a paid career fire department. But outside the city of Manhattan, it's all Riley County Fire District 1, with the exception of the city of Riley still does maintain a volunteer fire station. But other than that, throughout the whole county, it's Riley County Fire District 1, which is all volunteer other than myself, our two deputy chiefs, and our administrative assistant. Everybody else is volunteer. So roughly we have about 130 volunteers. We really need about another 30 or 50 more volunteers. So if you have any interest in being a volunteer firefighter, we have 15 stations spread out across the county, everywhere from Zinedale and Ashland all the way up to Swede Creek and Peach Grove and Mayday, and almost everywhere in between. And so don't hesitate to go to the county's website, and you don't have to be that, you know, 25 or 30-year-old perfect shape, fitness, dragon slayer type person to come volunteer for us.
You know, I mean, we'll take those.
We will take those.
Yes.
But you can be somebody that, hey, I'm comfortable driving a pickup in a pasture or driving a water tender truck, just hauling water to you, but I'm not necessarily going to go out and slay the dragon. But I can be a truck driver. I can do some of those tasks at a house fire. I can come and be the outside person, but I'm not going to put on the air pack and crawl into the house and save somebody. But I can sure hook the hose up to the hydrant and do water supply and traffic control and some of those other things. And so we are always looking for volunteers. And, you know, we have volunteers from all walks of life, men, women, you know, low socioeconomic status people to multimillionaires and everybody in between. So, you know, city folks, farmers, and business professionals to construction laborers and everything in between. So don't think that there's not a place for you. And even if you live in the heart of Manhattan, we have fire stations all the way around the outside of Manhattan. And like I said, clear to the, you know, 40 minutes north and 25 minutes south of town. So if you have any desire or know anybody that would be willing to be a volunteer firefighter, we are hungry for new volunteers. And so you can just go to the county website, search volunteer firefighter, and find the application process.
Now, you said you don't have to be that young person, but what is the minimum age requirement to become a volunteer?
18.
Okay. Just wanted to make sure.
Yep. You, the minimum requirements are 18 years old, be able to pass a background check and a drug screen, and then have either a valid driver's license or high school diploma.
Gotcha. Just thought in case someone's listening and wants, you know, to do it, if they're not quite that 18, they just know they need to wait till they turn 18 and then they can reach out to you guys. So
correct.
Awesome.
And then on the emergency management side, we have the CERT team, and Lori manages that. And so if you don't think fire's your thing, but you do want to volunteer, we have the CERT, which is the Community Emergency Response Team, which is kind of a disaster, first aid disaster response type of thing. So something to kind of train you to be the help your neighbors and maybe get called out to help, you know, like, for example, when we did the vaccine clinics and COVID testing clinics, you know, the CERT volunteers came out and helped direct traffic and register people. And then we also have WARN, which is our amateur radio people that help do storm spotting. And so if you're an amateur radio operator or interested in becoming one, disasters aren't necessarily your thing, but you like watching storms and have some interest in amateur radio, we have the WARN folks, WARN group, that is also an opportunity to volunteer and support your community. So
I wanted to get sentimental for just a moment. You asked earlier what our favorite parts of our job are.
Mm-hmm.
So Russell kind of mentioned, you know, the chance to be useful is really great to me, and every day is different. But the thing that I like the very, very most has to do with the volunteer fire department. So, you know, sometimes you get down about humanity and think, oh, what's the world coming to? And everybody is mean to each other. And, you know, it's just exhausting. And when I have those days, I go hang out with the volunteer fire department, because they have folks who have taken time off work, have taken vacation time on a day that's 104 degrees to go fight a fire on a hillside, and are willing to do that work, covered in sweat. It's miserable. It's hard work. And they're out there doing it just because they care enough to do it. They're not getting paid. They're, I mean, a small little stipend that might pay for the gas to get there. But they're out there doing this crucial work that's hard, it's uncomfortable, it's dangerous. They're risking their safety, devoting their time just because they care enough to do it. And that it just restores my faith in humanity. Like, that's as sentimental as it gets for me, that wow, there are still these people out there, and it's wonderful. I really appreciate it. So I'm grateful to get a chance to get to know these folks and get to see behind the scenes a little bit about the great work that they do. But it's that big. It's that big to me. And I am honored to have the chance to tell the public about it, because people don't know. Like, we just go about our daily lives, and we don't know that our neighbor down the road got up at 2 a.m. to go help somebody who was in a vehicle accident or put out a fire or all of the wonderful things that they do. And I've been so impressed. So thanks for giving me a chance to talk about it, because I think it's something I want everybody to know.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Yeah, and I would just echo what Vivian said. Obviously, we couldn't have a volunteer fire department without the volunteers, and there's a bunch of real dedicated people here to serving the community, and they're doing it because of their pride and their love of the community, not because it's so pleasant all the time. And so, but most of them really love it, and you know, some people are golfers or hunters or fishermen, and a lot of them are too. But being a volunteer firefighter is just their thing, and we couldn't do it without them. And I would like just echo that. I want to thank them for all their time and dedication, and I'm fortunate I get paid to do it. They're volunteering to do it.
Awesome. Thank you, guys.
Amazing. And then can you remind us where we can get notifications for emergencies and sign up for those?
Go for it.
So to sign up for the Everbridge system, which is our local alerts, emergency notification system, go to the Riley County website, which is rileycountyks.gov/alert or alerts. Either one will get you there, or Google Everbridge or Riley County Emergency Notifications. You'll get the opportunity to create an account. It's free. You get to choose how you want to be notified. So we will do phone calls, text messages, and email messages, and you can do all three. So, you know, first you'll get a text message. If you don't respond, you'll get a phone call. If you don't respond, you'll get an email. And then you choose which alerts you want to receive. Sometimes those freeze warnings that happen at 3 a.m. are a little bit annoying. So if you don't need to know when it's going to freeze, if you're not an ag producer, maybe don't select those.
Or gardener.
But you get to customize it and then go back in and make changes, sign up for which areas you want, choose your addresses, all that good stuff. So easy to customize. And then if you want a hand with it, call the office and we'll walk you through.
Okay. And then you can also find more information about Riley County Emergency Management also through social media as well, correct?
Yes. We have a Facebook account and an X account. Twitter, or the artist formerly known as Twitter.
Yeah, there you go.
So we post information there as well.
And that we can just find by searching Riley County Emergency Management or?
Riley County Emergency Management. Indeed.
Perfect.
All right. Well, thank you guys so much for joining us today. We appreciate the information and hope that everyone stays prepared.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, Becky, why don't you tell us what's going on this week?
Well, Katie, tonight is Flight Crew Coffee's in-flight entertainment again from 7 to 9 p.m. This week they have the Bell Brothers who will be performing. I went out and did a little research about them because actually one of them was there at the last when I went a couple weeks ago. Mm-hmm. And they actually perform jazz. And they so they actually have some of their own original stuff. Both of them, brothers. They were born in Manhattan, raised by their American father and Colombian mother, have spent time in Colombia since they graduated high school, and now have come back to Manhattan and are sharing their musical talents with us here.
Very cool. That will definitely be interesting to hear some local jazz. That's an interesting one that you don't hear very often.
Yes. And I was talking with Heather at the last time that I went to Flight Crew, and she said they do an amazing job.
Yeah.
And they're someone who comes in fairly regularly over there for that in-flight entertainment. So definitely something I'm planning to check out tonight.
Yeah. And then tomorrow, you can start your morning with the Downtown Farmers Market from 9 to 1. They not only are going to have their typical farmers market, but they are also having an Easter egg hunt on Saturday.
Yes. So they'll have Easter eggs throughout. They'll be at different vendors, that sort of thing. I've never actually went for the Easter egg market, so I'm not sure exactly what to expect. I just found a little bit of information today when I was looking up what events we have going on around the area. So that's what I found. So hopefully everyone goes out and has a great time. So
yeah, awesome. And then also Saturday, lots of things coming up with Easter. So,
absolutely.
A&H Farms at 9 in the morning is having a four legs and Easter eggs event.
Yes.
For your puppies.
Yeah. So this event is a tickets required event because of having dogs. They need to limit the number that are out there. Mm-hmm. Can't have it be just a free for all with all the dogs from the community joining. But they'll have I just lost my train. They will have photo opportunities with an Easter bunny and other photo opportunities throughout the farm, and you can just go out and enjoy the space, and they'll have lots of fun things for you to do with your dog while you're out there.
Yeah, awesome. And then again on Saturday the 30th, Manhattan Brewing Company is hosting Pups and Pints from 2 to 5. So after you take your dogs out for Easter eggs at A&H Farms, you can head down to Manhattan Brewing Company, and they'll have pup cup treats and things like that free of charge.
Absolutely.
To go with your afternoon drink.
Yeah, go get your dog all worn out at the farm.
Uh-huh.
And then come back in and have a relaxing beverage at Manhattan Brewing Company.
Yeah,
and
get
your
little
dog
treat.
Can have a little treat too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Yep. And then next week on Wednesday is Singo again at Finn's. And yes, I'm always talking about Singo, but it's so much fun, Katie. It's kind of like a cross between music trivia and bingo because
right.
you have to figure out who's singing the song or what the song title is, depending on what category we're working in, and then find them on your board. Sometimes me, be the unlucky one who doesn't have the song title or the name of the band on their board, doesn't get to mark anything. But once you get that five in a row bingo, then you get a prize. And when I've been there before, it's been a gift card to Finn's. So kind of nice to be able to take some money off your tab that way.
Yeah, definitely a fun time. Definitely a good thing to take money off your tab.
Absolutely.
And then the next day, Thursday, April 4th, the Manhattan Area Chamber of Commerce is having their Business Brew networking event again. So that's going to be 8 in the morning till 9. And I believe that's just right across the street from us at Rock Hill.
Yeah, it is. And that is just a coffee hour. You go in, remind everybody, bring your business card because you can get entered to win a door prize. But then it's just walk around, talk to other people from the community, learn more about what they do. And it's just kind of this informal way to just kind of get it, you know, get that networking in for the morning and then head to work after that. So.
Absolutely. Definitely check that out. And then in the afternoon of Thursday, April 4th at 1, Flint Hills Ventures will break ground for Building K. I think you're going to know a little bit more about this groundbreaking than I am.
Yeah, so this groundbreaking is actually part of an economic development agreement with the City of Manhattan City Commission and Flint Hills Ventures to attract new businesses to Manhattan. And this new building that is going to be built where they're going to break ground is actually going to be an industrial warehouse facility.
Okay.
They're building it in hopes of attracting businesses to the Manhattan area and just continuing to have that economic growth here. So that groundbreaking will be held. That's on Kretschmer Drive, and they're asking for everyone that's attending to park in the McCall Pattern Company parking lot. Obviously, McCall Pattern Company not here anymore, but that's the easiest way to explain what parking lot it is because everybody knows where that building is.
Gotcha. And then Wednesday, April 10th, the next week, Business After Hours is going to be hosted at Wareham Hall.
Correct.
So a little bit more networking. What time does that one start, Becky?
That is at 5:30 and usually lasts a little over an hour. Again, bring those business cards. Yep. Be ready to network with those community members. They usually have delicious food catered to these, just kind of like a finger foods, like something you can eat while you wander around and talk to others. And then, again, they always have some sort of door prize with that as well. So that's the other reason to bring that business card along. And then on Thursday, I mean, the chamber is just busy, busy the next couple of weeks. There'll be a ribbon cutting just down the street from us for Wild and Blooming. They are a floral company, which was started in North Central Kansas. And they have grown enough to where now, instead of just working out of her home, she now has the storefront here just down the street.
Very nice.
Yeah.
That's definitely cool. A good place to get your flowers for prom or
weddings, any occasion,
anything really.
Yeah.
So
absolutely,
definitely check that out once they open there. And I think that that's all the news. That's all the events we have coming up for the next 2 weeks.
That's all that I was able to fit in. I'm sure there are more, and definitely always go out and check out that community calendar on littleapplepost.com. And if you know of an event happening on that page where the community calendar is, it tells you how to submit your event if we do not have it already on our calendar.
Absolutely. Check that out. And thank you again, Russell and Vivian, for joining us from Riley County Emergency Management. Definitely interesting to talk to them, and it's good to have a little preparedness in our lives. So
absolutely.
Yeah. Yep. Thank you guys again. And remember, a locally grown apple a day keeps our community unique in every way. We will see you guys next time.
Bye.